So just first of all, just to sort of recap a little bit, for especially for those of you who weren't here last week, so Ratnaprabha was talking last week about Sangharakshita's life and in a way about his going for refuge, about his journey as a Buddhist. And it really is quite remarkable. I mean, I've now read his autobiography. He's written a very long autobiography of 4 volumes, so there's quite a lot of reading to go through. But it is really, really interesting to read. And in a way, when you reread it, I've reread it when I was actually going on pilgrimage in India and when I was going to the places that he's also travelled through. And it's quite particular, you know, to read it in that setting. But on rereading it, it's more and more becomes more and more amazing what he's actually done. You know, it's quite extraordinary. So, you know, he reads sort of these 2 texts at age 16, the Diamond Sutra and the Platform Sutra, which are like rationally, they can't really be understood. Those texts are very mysterious texts. And he sort of read them when he was 16. They'd just been translated and he's just found them, I think, in a second-hand bookshop or something. And he thought, I don't understand those, but this is definitely true, you know, and I'm a Buddhist and I've always been a Buddhist. And then he just happens, there was this kind of, you could call it synchronicity or just coincidence, but he was posted in the Second World War in India. You know, he was on a boat and he was sort of looking after the communications. Because he'd been ill as a child, he wasn't really drafted as a soldier as such, but he was a signalman or something like that, yes. But he was actually posted in India. And then he struck up a friendship with an Indian man there. And as soon as the Second World War ended, they decided they were just going to wander through India and find a teacher who would ordain them as monks. And all he had to go on at that time, you know, not many Buddhist texts were really translated yet, was the few texts that he'd come across. So they did it in the traditional manner. So they literally burnt their passports, burnt their money, because it said in those texts, you know, you don't carry money. As a, you know, if you live a Buddhist life, you give all that up. Burnt their clothes, made themselves some robes from rags, and wandered through India looking for a teacher. And if you imagine that, I mean, that's a bit crazy, really. I mean, especially at that time, it's totally unconventional and very risky. And even people in India, you know, they were looking at these two. I mean, one of them was Indian, but especially him as a Westerner, I suppose. You know, what is he doing? And, you know, how was he going to survive? And he went and did the traditional thing of begging for food. Nobody in India even was doing that any longer, you know, but somehow, I mean, as people were seeing that, it was also, they thought it was crazy, but they also thought it was quite inspiring that somebody would actually do that, you know. So it was quite amazing what he did. And just one little story, which I really loved that. His first teacher, once he was ordained as a Theravadin monk, his first teacher was an Indian teacher. And he was very eccentric. A lot of his teachers were very eccentric, but this teacher, Kashyapji, apparently he was very, very fat. And spent most of the time sleeping on a, I remember in one of his of the books, you know, he studies the Pali scriptures with Kashyapji, and Kashyapji sleeps most of the day, it seems like, and snores very loudly and sort of lies on this bed. But whenever Sangharakshita asks him a question, he seems to sort of come to life and answer the question. And so he's sort of this quite extraordinary man. And Sangharakshita found him very, very frustrating. You know, he was he did things spontaneously and never did what he was expected to do, you know, and everything always changed. And he spent a lot of time being very frustrated, wanting things to happen in a certain way. And he decided that he was just being too willful and too egotistical. And what he was going to do is he was going to make a vow that, again, like the traditional Buddhist monks, that he was going to just say yes to whatever his teacher asked him to do. And he was going to completely overcome his preferences. And then, you know, the next thing, his teacher takes him up to this little town in Kalimpong, and I think you were talking about this last week, weren't you, Ratnaprabha? Takes him to this tiny random town in Kalimpong where he wants to set up a kind of Buddhist centre, and then it doesn't work out for his teacher. So he says to him, I've had enough of this, I'm going back down to Bodh Gaya, but you stay here and work for the good of Buddhism, you know, in this random town where he doesn't know anyone, where there's no other Westerners. And because he'd made the vow of just saying yes to whatever his teacher said, he stayed there. And he stayed there for 14 years. You know, he didn't just stay for a week or something. You know? You think this is extraordinary. So he really took, I mean, whatever else you can say about Sangharakshan, he's a very complicated man, but he did take going for refuge seriously. Seriously did it. And, you know, put Buddhism sort of in the centre of his life and what he, how he understood it. So very, I find that very inspiring. So he did spend 20 years really as a Theravadin monk in India, and then, won't tell you the story why, but he ended up coming back to the UK as an English person. And he ended up sort of thinking, well, you know, Buddhism was at the centre of his life, and it had been at the centre of his life for 20 years. He'd been asked to come back to the UK to try and help what's now the Buddhist Society. It still exists, actually, in Eccleston Square, and another little Buddhist centre called the Hampstead Vihara, which no longer exists. The two organisations had fallen out with each other, and they wanted him to help to mediate, because at this point he was quite well known as a Buddhist scholar and as somebody who was very good with communication. So they asked him, can you come and help us sort these problems out between us? So he came back to the UK, and coming back and sort of stepping back from his life as a monk in India, I suppose, made him ask himself, well, what is it? You know, I've had these teachers, these Tibetan teachers, a Chinese teacher, an Indian teacher, and now in the UK there is these people trying to live as Buddhists. You know, what is it that is the uniting thing, or the thing that brings these kind of quite diverse teachings together from all the Buddhist schools? He'd got quite disillusioned in India about the split between monastic and lay. You know, that quite often monks, he thought the monks that he'd met didn't really live up to the ideal of a monk, of living a humble Buddhist life and really giving their life to the Dharma. Quite often they were monks and they liked the status of it. You know, they were seen as prestigious, they were fed, they didn't have to work, you know. So there was quite a lot of corruption going on in the traditional Sangha, which he was a bit disillusioned by. Then he came to the UK and he became very disillusioned with what he saw happening at the Buddhist Society in the Hampstead Vihara, because what he was thinking was the problem was that both these organisations ran a bit like clubs, so people just went there on a Sunday afternoon to hear a Buddhist talk or maybe spent an hour meditating, but then it didn't really affect the rest of their lives. And the people who ran the institutions also just seemed to see it as a kind of a bit of a hobby, you know, something they did on a Sunday, but not really, it didn't really affect their lives deeply. So he decided that what he thought was really needed, if Buddhism was to flourish in the West, and if it was to flourish in the modern world, I suppose, was something quite new, which was like to kind of revive the spirit of the Buddha, of really going for refuge, which meant really dedicating your life to the Buddha, to his teachings, and to form a Sangha, just like the Sangha around the Buddha. Not just like the Sangha around the Buddha, because we live in a different world, and, you know, he was thinking, wandering around London, there's lovely stories of him actually sitting in pubs drinking Guinness and pondering these questions, you know, and thinking, how can we apply these teachings to life in the city, to life in the modern world, in a way that really brings them to life and that really affects people's lives deeply? And the order and the movement, I suppose the Triratna order and movement grew out of that, him thinking, well, that most important thing is that people commit themselves to the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha, and commit themselves completely, you know, whatever that means. And it might not mean becoming a monk or a nun. He thought he didn't want to set up a monastic movement. He thought there is this quite famous aphorism of his saying, commitment is primary, lifestyle is secondary. And he didn't mean that lifestyle was unimportant. You know, he did sort of teach people that your lifestyle should be in accordance with the precepts, not harming anything particularly and not stealing, etc. But he thought it just doesn't really matter. It's kind of secondary importance how you apply, you know, how you are a Buddhist. But the most important thing is that you really want to live by the precepts, live by the Buddhist teachings, whatever you're doing, whether you've got a family, whether you're married, whether you've got children, whether you're single, whether, you know, whatever. People from all walks of life, men and women, monk or monastic, that didn't really matter. But what mattered is that you didn't just do it as a little tiny bit of your week or your life, but you dedicated your life to it, really living by the teachings. So that was the very particular thing that he brought to the order. And we probably will hear more in this kind of series that we've just started about the particular emphasis that he put on different things. So, I mean, one thing that I will just give you the headlines of is, out of this emphasis that he placed on going for refuge and committing yourself, also came very much the emphasis that, yes, each person individually needed to dedicate themselves to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, but out of that would also then naturally come that they would dedicate themselves to each other and to the world. And actually kind of creating, he was talking at the time about creating a new society, which I think Ratnaprabha is going to talk about later in the series. And just living in a different way, exemplifying living in a different way. And he didn't mean living in a different way necessarily outwardly. You know, people might still live in families, although he encouraged people also to live in communities. But more living in a different way, meaning not living for money, power and status, but living from a motivation of what he called the love mode, you know, sort of love for each other, compassion, wisdom and compassion. So to really try and live, trying to live as wisely and as compassionately as possible and have that as your main aim rather than have status and power and money and riches as your aim. So going back to the Buddha's radical intention, really. So he went right back in his emphasis of going for refuge to what the Buddha, what he thought or what he understood the Buddha to have discovered when he sat under that Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya gaining enlightenment, which is that what he had seen, in a way, when he became enlightened, potentially could change people's minds completely and could potentially change the world and turn something around quite radically. So that, so that life and the world could become more wise and more compassionate in a way. So what he saw, I mean, in a nutshell, was that there is a lot of suffering in the world, there is impermanence, that nothing is solid, and that the only sane thing to do in the face of that is to be wise and to be compassionate and to put all your energy into seeing the reality of things as they are and helping each other see that too. So very, very radical, and he went back to that radical discovery of the Buddha. And I found it quite interesting when I was thinking about this talk, like how do we apply this today? There was some of you also maybe have sometimes been to the LBC, the other London Buddhist Centre, which is part of this movement too, and they've just had a winter retreat, and the theme of the winter retreat was this quite sort of daring title of what the world needs now. And there are some of the talks are online, and really the talks are all about what the world needs now are the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, and an understanding of what that means, you know, what going for refuge means. Because with everything that's going on in the world, especially like so many forces against sort of truthfulness, against the precepts. Again, you know, there's so many wars, there's so much greed, there seems to be a lot of lies. I mean, lies seems to be the main thing at the moment that's really taking over. So what's really important in times when a lot of that is happening and when things seem to be disintegrating is to come back to the very simple precepts and the, you know, going for refuge to something that will really help. And live through all these very difficult times. So I'll just read you a little section of, there's a very ancient text called the Dhammapada, which I think I've quoted from before, which very beautifully and poetically talks about going for refuge and what it means. So what it says is, many people out of fear flee for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees, and shrines. But in reality, this is not a safe refuge. This is not a true refuge. Fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from suffering. He who goes for refuge to the enlightened one, to the truth, and to the spiritual community, and who sees with perfect wisdom the Four Noble Truths, namely suffering, the origin of suffering, the passing beyond suffering, and the Noble Eightfold Way leading to the pacification of suffering. For him, this is a safe refuge. This is a true refuge. Having gone to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So some of you who've been to the winter retreat will probably recognize these words. We've done the kind of Dhammapada Puja there. So it's really what it means, why it's using the word refuge. It is quite an evocative word. You know, you can sort of think there is danger, so you want to go to a safe place. But what is really safe? And what the Buddha was saying, that what is nothing that is impermanent and that will not last and that will pass away, nothing in this world, in this mundane world, is safe. It might be safe temporarily, but it's not ultimately safe. The only thing that is safe is really developing your mind and looking at reality and helping each other and building community. That is what will give you an inner safety, in a way, whatever happens to you externally. That's what he was kind of saying. I've sort of looked at a few of the writings of Sangharakshita about going for refuge, and I'll give you a little. I think in the newsletter we'll also send out a few sort of book tips and talks that you can look up by Sangharakshita himself, which are very interesting about this theme. But what Sangharakshita always does, whatever he talks about, he looks it up in the dictionary first. He looks up what is actually the definition of something. And it's quite interesting. It's quite sort of a thorough like that. So the definition of refuge is, if you look in the dictionary or maybe on Wikipedia now, is that which shelters, protects from danger, distress and calamity, and also a place inaccessible to the enemy. So that's quite interesting, those two kind of slants on the word refuge. So it's therefore essential to find, in order to gain liberation or freedom from suffering, you need to get to a refuge. And it's important to recognize that no ordinary person or place or thing can really ultimately offer these qualities, like I've just said. It needs to be something beyond the mundane, something beyond of what we can really understand. And we have to really trust, I suppose, and have confidence in that we can develop our minds, and there are dimensions that we don't even know about and that we can get to, that we can understand things in a way beyond of how we understand things now, just with our rational minds. There's another dimension of experience, which we haven't yet reached, but we can reach it through practice. And it's not just through thinking, it's through meditation. It's also, I think Bodhilila is going to talk next week a bit about devotional practice, chanting. You have to sort of engage the whole of you, body, speech and mind, in order to reach these dimensions. Not only your rational mind, your body, your speech, your mind, all of you has to be involved in that. And through this dedicated practice, we can then develop deeper and deeper levels of going for refuge. So first of all, you know, we might be a bit interested, for example, in coming along here and learning to meditate and thinking there's something here. So it's quite provisional. We're trying it out a little bit. We're not quite sure. Then once we've maybe had a bit of experience of, oh, there's something here, and, you know, you have meditation experience or you have experiences of insight in whichever way, it becomes a bit more, you gain more confidence and trust, and you might get to the stage, like some of us have here, you know, of wanting to actually join the order and thinking, I really want to put this at the centre of my life. So then your going for refuge becomes a bit stronger, more effective. And then you can go beyond that, really seeing what life is like. There is a step called stream entry, where apparently if you get there, I haven't got there yet, but apparently if you get there, you can't fall back. You're so confident that this is the way and this is the path that, you know, whatever happens to you, you can't fall back. And then there is enlightenment, of course, like the Buddha reached. And there's one, the other thing I just wanted to say for refuge before I go more specifically into like the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, is that there is a kind of common misunderstanding of the teaching, which sometimes, well, there are some philosophers. There's a philosopher called Slavoj Žižek, which some of you might have heard about, and you might have even read his paper. He wrote a paper a few years back, which I think we need to really take seriously as Western Buddhists, because what he says in there is something that all of us need to think about. But he was criticizing Western Buddhism. He was sort of offering a critique of it, really. And what he was saying is just escapism. It's just, you know, you want to be calm, you want to be mindful, you want to be quiet, you want to create these havens of places, but really isn't that completely denying that actually the world isn't like that, you know? And it's kind of, instead, we should all get involved in the messiness of life, etc. But I think what he was talking about, I mean, I think there can be a tendency maybe in all of us to want to do that sometimes, but there is a misunderstanding in it. If you really go for refuge, you're not running away from the messiness of life, but you're trying to find a good basis, a deep basis for facing the messiness and the frighteningness and the of life and the suffering from a place where you can offer more to it, in a way, you know. So you're transforming your mind in order to affect the world and in order to be able to respond to it from a better place. So it's not escapism. It's not meant to be escapism anyway. But we need to make sure that it isn't for ourselves. It's a turning towards the harshness and the suffering rather than a turning away from it, ideally. But turning towards it in a positive way, not in a sort of martyring way. So there are, you know, escapism would be like, you know, I know it myself, you know, I sometimes can get really sort of scared of what's happening in the world. I don't want to read the news anymore. I want to distract myself. I just want to watch some rubbish television or go shopping or through eating. You know, some people, if there's a lot of suffering in their lives, if you drink or take drugs, I mean, those are all sort of escapist, you know, things that distract you and things that shut you down. But meditation and mindfulness really should be doing the opposite, you know, not escaping from it. It should be able to make you face it without distortions, more nakedly in a way. There is one teaching that the Buddha gave where he said, in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only the heard, in the cognized, only the cognized. So what he was teaching a lot was, we have to take the veils away and really look at reality as it is, accepting it, not pushing it away, not pulling it towards us, just accepting it as it is and being with what is, which is very challenging, but it also very liberating. Let's have a look at the time. Talking longer than I thought I would. So just to say a little bit about the three refuges. So the Buddha is kind of a refuge because he exemplifies how an ordinary person can, you know, start as an ordinary person. He started as quite a privileged, ordinary sort of a prince who lived in a palace and who didn't have to face very many hardships and was sheltered from it. But because he had kind of a motivation from within himself to find out more, because he saw suffering and wanted to find a way out of it, just through that motivation, he could gain enlightenment. You know, he had enough energy going in that direction and he could transform himself. So it's an example of what we can all do. If we can get all our energies united, going in the direction of wanting to see reality as it is and be of as much help to ourselves and the world as possible, we can do the same. You know, that's why the Buddha is a refuge. And the Dharma is his teachings, which can provide us with a kind of framework and with methods for doing that. So the meditations he taught, the teachings he gave that can inspire us, can just help us going in that direction. And then the Sangha is a refuge because the Sangha of people who have developed enough of a connection, I suppose, with the Buddha and his teachings can help us it can help us feel less alone, I suppose, and it can help us encourage each other, inspire each other, build friendships with each other. There's another teaching of the Buddha, which is quite a famous teaching, is where one of his main followers, Ananda, he comes very excitedly to the Buddha, and he's been thinking or he's been reflecting in his meditation, and he says, "I've understood now." He said, "I've understood that spiritual friendship is half of the spiritual life, isn't it?" And then the Buddha says, "Oh no." Did he say, "Say not so, Ananda"? He said, "It's the whole of the spiritual life, friendship, spiritual friendship, it's the whole of the spiritual life." So it's very important that the Buddha was teaching that people build friendships, help each other, support each other, encourage each other in following this path, because it's difficult to do it by yourself. Maybe I'll leave it there. Oh, yeah, one more thing I just wanted to say, because I want us to go into a bit of a reflection. So I just wanted to say, I suppose at different times, I mean, I've found at different times of my, since I've learned to meditate and since I've regarded myself as a Buddhist, and I can find sort of different teachings or different stages of the Buddha's life inspiring according to what's happening in my own life, you know, something that connects up with my life and what's happening in my life at the moment. So I suppose at the moment I've just only recently sort of started doing a bit more Dharma teaching. So I'm quite inspired. I keep thinking of this. There is a story of the Buddha just when he'd gained enlightenment, and he sort of wanders about and he's thinking, how am I going to communicate this, and who am I going to communicate it to, and is anybody going to understand it, and am I going to be able to put it into words? You know, that kind of, how do you teach this stuff? From which, especially from a place that's very far from being enlightened, you know, how do you do that? So it's quite interesting sort of thinking for me at the moment to think of the Buddha at that point where he was quite beset with doubt. You know, would he be able to? Would anybody want to listen? Etc. So when we do the reflection, you know, just think about, well, you know, how, like when you think, what's your connection with the Buddha, or what's your connection with a teaching, what's your connection with the Sangha at the moment? Really think, what's happening in my life right now and what's important to me right now? I mean, Sangha, for example, for me, when I think of Sangha, at the moment I do actually think of the West London Sangha as my, the Sangha that's, not that I go for refuge to, because really the Sangha you go for refuge to should be the Sangha of enlightened beings, you know, and we're not all enlightened beings here. But from where I am at the moment, I think like joining this Sangha and joining sort of the teachers of this centre is quite important to me, and that's my connection, you know. So that's what it is, the thing that springs to my mind at the moment when I think of Sangha. For you, it might be a particular, your study group, or just one friend or something. So it's interesting to think, you know, what do these three words, the Buddha, what springs to mind, the Dharma, is there a particular teaching that springs to mind, the Sangha, what's your connection at the moment? And if you think about it like that, that will help you. It'll give you sort of a direction of travel if you want to sort of explore more what it would be like provisionally to go for refuge.